right, ready to dive into another case.
Absolutely. Always ready for a good deep dive.
This one takes us to Lake Tahoe. Beautiful spot. Imagine you've finally saved enough to buy that perfect piece of land right on the shores, crystal clear water, mountain views.
Sounds idyllic.
This dream come true, right? But just as you're ready to start building, the local government slams on the brakes.
Oh, what happened?
A full-on development moratorium. No new construction allowed. Period.
Wow, that's got to be frustrating.
This is the story of Tahoe Sierra Preservation Council versus the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency.
Ah, this one went all the way to Supreme Court, right? Huge implications for land use law.
It did. So what was going on at Lake Tahoe that led to such drastic measures?
Well, back in the 80s, Lake Tahoe was facing a real crisis.
What kind of crisis?
All the rapid development around the lake, it was causing so much runoff. Pollution, sedimentation, you name it.
So we're picturing pristine waters turning cloudy, the ecosystem at risk.
Exactly, and that's where the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency stepped in.
TRPA, right.
That's the one. A bi-state agency created to protect the Tahoe Basin. And they didn't mess around. They slapped on not one, but two development moratoria.
Back to back.
Pretty much. First, they enacted Ordinance 81-5, lasted from 81 to 83. People thought they could start building again, but then, boom, Resolution 83-21 extended the moratorium until 84.
32 months where almost all development was banned. That's got to be a tough pill to swallow for those landowners.
Nearly 2,000 of them stuck with property they couldn't touch.
I can imagine that didn't go over well.
It didn't. They sued, claimed those moratoria violated the Fifth Amendment's takings clause.
Which basically says the government can't just take private property for public use without just compensation.
Exactly.
And that's where this case gets really interesting. Because it's not just about those landowners at Lake Tahoe.
No, it gets to the heart of it.
How far can the government go to protect the environment? Where's the line when it comes to private property rights?
It's a classic clash, environmental protection versus individual property rights. This case became a battleground for that very tension.
So how did this legal battle play out? How did it end up at the Supreme Court?
Well, the landowners, obviously frustrated, they went to district court. And actually, they won.
They did?
First round, yeah. But then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, they reversed that decision, sided with the TRPA.
Back and forth.
Yep. So the Supreme Court, seeing this conflict, they stepped in to settle the score.
And to make matters even more complicated, there's another wrinkle.
What's that?
The dissenting justices pointed out that because of various court injunctions, that development ban actually lasted nearly 6 years for some property.
6 years.
6 years. Suddenly temporary takes on a whole new meaning.
It does make you wonder, where's the line? At what point does it stop being temporary?
Exactly. Did the Supreme Court say that all temporary bans are okay, no matter how long?
They didn't go for a hard and fast rule. They actually refused to say that all temporary deprivations are automatic takings.
Interesting. So what did they do?
They turned to the Penn Central test.
Okay, for those of us who aren't property law experts, break down the Penn Central test for us.
Sure. It's a three-pronged analysis. Courts use it to figure out if a government regulation has basically gone too far, so far that it's effectively a taking, requiring that just compensation.
Makes sense. So what are the three prongs?
First, you look at the economic impact on the landowner. How much did that regulation actually diminish the property's value? Second, you consider the landowner's investment-backed expectations. Did they have a reasonable expectation of using their property in a specific way?
Okay, so far so good. What's the third?
The third prong looks at the character of the government action itself. Was it a legit public purpose, or was it arbitrary, overreaching?
So it's not just a simple question of, did the government take something? It's a much more nuanced analysis.
It really is. And the Tahoe Sierra case is a perfect example of how this Penn Central test works in real life.
So how did the Supreme Court apply these factors to the Lake Tahoe case? Did they think that TRPA had basically stolen the landowner's property?
Well, they acknowledged the moratoria did cause some hardship, but they focused on the fact that the loss of use was temporary. Those owners could still develop their land later.
So the court wasn't looking at it as a permanent seizure of the property.
Right. They even contrasted it with another big case, Lucas v. South Carolina Coastal Council, where a permanent ban on coastal building was considered a taking because it totally wiped out the property's use. In Tahoe Sierra, the temporary moratorium didn't have that permanent effect.
Ah, so the temporary nature of the restrictions was key to the court's decision. If TRPA had made it a permanent ban, would that have changed things?
It very likely would have. That difference between a temporary restriction and a complete and permanent loss of value, that's central to how the court saw this case.
That makes a lot of sense. So the economic impact was temporary. What about the other two Penn Central factors, the investment-backed expectations and the character of the government's action? How did the court handle those?
On the investment-backed expectations, the court essentially said, look, the area had been subject to land use regulations for a while. They knew development wasn't a free-for-all. And as for the government's actions, they found TRPA was acting reasonably, trying to protect the lake. They even quoted Justice Holmes, if regulations were considered takings every time they decreased a property's value, government could hardly go on.
Powerful statement right there. The need to balance individual rights with the common good. But of course, not everyone was on board with the majority, right?
You got it. We had some pretty strong dissenting opinions in this case.
Dissenting opinions, always interesting to see where the justices disagree. Who was leading the charge against the majority here?
Chief Justice Rehnquist, he wasn't buying it. He argued that 6 years, even if you call it temporary, is basically a leasehold.
Like the government's just squatting on their property.
Exactly. Using it for their own purposes without paying the owners. He brought up First English Evangelical Lutheran Church versus County of Los Angeles.
That case rings a bell.
The Supreme Court said even temporary takings require compensation. Rehnquist was saying the length shouldn't matter. Taking's a taking. 6 months or 6 years.
So he felt the majority was kind of dodging the real issue by getting hung up on that temporary label.
Pretty much. And he wasn't alone. Justice Thomas also dissented. He really went after the majority's approach.
Oh. How so?
He called it temporal slicing of property rights, argued that a total ban, even if it's temporary, should always mean compensation is due. For him, how long it lasts should only affect how much you pay, not whether it was a taking at all.
Wait, back up. Temporal slicing, what does that even mean?
It's basically saying the majority was trying to have it both ways. They'd admit the moratorium was a big deal for the landowners, but then they'd say, oh, but it's temporary, so it's not a taking.
Right, so Thomas is saying that's not how property rights work. It's about being able to use your property, period, regardless of how long some restrictions in place.
Exactly. He thought the decision gave the government way too much power to mess with property rights without any real consequences.
Okay, this is where I'm getting tripped up. Didn't First English already settle this whole temporary takings needing compensation thing?
You're right. Good catch. The majority's answer was that First English was about what happens after a taking's been decided. In Tahoe Sierra, they were still figuring out if a taking even happened.
So it hinges on the timing, how the court's looking at the issue. First English was about consequences. Tahoe Sierra is about did it even happen in the first place?
You got it. And that's one of the big takeaways from Tahoe Sierra. The government has some room to maneuver when it comes to these temporary land use restrictions, especially if it's for planning purposes.
As long as they don't completely trash the property's value in the process.
Right. But it leaves us in kind of a gray area. When does temporary actually become so long that it crosses that line and becomes a taking?
Yeah, the court didn't exactly give us a calendar to work with.
Nope, no magic number of years. That's what makes this case so important. It sets a precedent, but it also leaves a lot of these questions open.
Which I guess means lots of work for lawyers figuring out the fine points.
Could be. But seriously, Tahoe Sierra is a landmark case. Really shapes how we think about property rights versus environmental protection.
Absolutely. So let's talk about what this means in practice. For landowners, for developers, anyone dealing with these kinds of land use decisions, what are the key takeaways? What did we learn from Tahoe Sierra? So we've got this complex case, lots of legal back and forth, but let's make it practical for our listeners out there. Landowners, developers, anyone caught up in these kinds of situations. What are the big takeaways? What can we learn from Tahoe Sierra?
Well, first off, I think it's important to remember there's no easy answer when it comes to regulatory takings. Like we've been talking about, the court didn't give us a clear-cut rule for temporary takings. Every case is going to depend on those Penn Central factors.
So it's more than just counting the days on a moratorium. It's about the bigger picture, the impact on that specific landowner.
Exactly. And that's where good legal help comes in. If you're a landowner and you're hit with one of these restrictions, you need someone who can really argue those Penn Central factors for you, show the economic impact, the expectations you had, and whether the government was really justified in doing what they did.
So being proactive, knowing your rights, and having good representation, that's key for landowners. What about developers? Any lessons for them from Tahoe Sierra?
For developers, I think the big takeaway is due diligence. Before you pour money into a project, especially somewhere like Lake Tahoe, an environmentally sensitive area, you got to do your homework, really dig into those land use regulations, and be aware that things can change. Tahoe Sierra shows us that governments have some leeway with these temporary moratoria. Developers need to factor that in.
Sounds like a healthy dose of caution is always a good idea. Don't just assume you can build whatever you want whenever you want, especially when it comes to places with unique environmental concerns.
Right, and it's not just about avoiding legal headaches. Developers who get the environmental context, who work with the community, with the agencies, they're the ones who are going to succeed in the long run. Building sustainably, that's good for business and the planet.
Finding that sweet spot where development and protecting the environment, they can both work.
That's what it's all about. You know, the Tahoe Sierra case, yeah, it's about this specific legal fight, but it points to something bigger. Finding that balance, private property rights, but also the need to protect these resources we all share. It's tricky, but it's essential for a sustainable future.
Well said. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Tahoe Sierra, what's the one thing you want our listeners to walk away with?
Property rights and environmental regulations, that's where the law gets really interesting. It's always changing. Tahoe Sierra gives us some guidance, but it also brings up more questions. Staying informed, understanding the legal side, and working with people who know this stuff, that's how you navigate these situations.
Absolutely. And remember, everyone, this case isn't just about a lake up in the mountains. It's about finding that balance between what individuals want and what's good for everyone. And that's something we see all over the law. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.